This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Want to welcome everybody to this evening's Marvel Report. I'm looking forward to tonight's guest. But before we begin, I've got to mention a few things. The views and opinions of the show are those of the host and guest and do not represent any sponsor, affiliate, or anybody else. I'm here to tell you, big times around here. I know last week I kind of reported the prediction show being this week. Of course, that wasn't necessarily my fault. I'm going to blame Germantown Runner because he is the producer of the show and he fed me bad information last week. And it falls on the first Tuesday in November, which is election night. That's why I do predictions on election night, because predicting the next year seems so much more fun than actually talking about the election. Okay, enough bad jokes about the election. I think every one of us will be happy to see it go until it comes back again. It's a bad, bad thing. But my guest tonight, well, I kind of wanted to step away from the election, but I kind of came back into it. Well, I think by the time the show's over tonight, you'll understand what I'm saying. My guest tonight is Andrew Pryor, fiction writer. I should point that out up off the top so nobody gets too bent out of shape. Andrew, how are you doing tonight?
I'm very well, Jim. How are you?
Doing pretty good. You're north of me, so are you ready for the next season?
I am. You know, I live in I'm looking out my window in my office right now at the, you know, the bank towers of downtown Toronto. So we are, of course, the biggest city in Canada, but we are very interested, you know, watching very closely current events in the United States. Let me put it that way.
I know because I'm gonna say this on air, and I'm gonna get hate mail for it. But a large portion of my engaged listenership, there, I said it nicely, is from Canada, which I don't understand. Of course, I'm from Western Pennsylvania, so I'm kind of almost your neighbor to the south, so to speak.
Yeah.
But it does fascinate me because there are states in the union that I've only ever had a handful of downloads from, and I get tons more email from Canada than the actual downloads in, like, Wyoming, the Dakotas, which surprises me.
Well, the thing about Canada, you know, just as an aside here, is that we look outside. Like we're always looking outside the window, looking at the world. I mean, we're more or less happy to fly under the radar, which allows us to look out the window more. So yeah, we're interested in a bunch of stuff.
As the joke goes, that I often tell people that, like, the aliens are watching us as a reality show. So kind of like that. Because, I mean, honestly, if I wasn't living here, I think I'd have to pay attention to it anyways, because it does get a little, yeah, reality-based TV. Yeah, that's about the only way to classify that. So, now you have this new book out. I will get there, I promise, but I want to save that for a few minutes because I need to get some backstory on you first before we get to there, because I think we have to mosey the path up to that instead of starting there and moseying back, because I think by understanding a little bit more about you, like, I think we kind of already started there, understanding that you have an interest in the United States kind of starts there. So take me back. When did you decide to become a writer, I guess, is my first question.
Well, okay. Well, this will take me way back, but I was always, always interested in storytelling. I was always writing, you know, from, even before I could write. I remember, my understanding is that kids, at public schools anyway, around here now aren't taught, handwriting anymore. But I remember, you know, having those treble clefs, almost like sort of like those musical lines drawn on the chalkboard, and, you know, the teacher would draw those treble, it looked like a, you know, those sort of five lines, and in between those lines you'd learn how to draw, you know, handwriting, and the capital letters went from the bottom to the top, and the smaller letters went halfway, and I was entranced by it. I remember writing in the air, handwriting in the air, and writing stories at my family dinner table, and it would drive my mother crazy. She knew I was, you know, sort of writing these stories about, probably about her, and I would have this imaginary pen and be writing it in the air, and she had an imaginary eraser and would go around following me and like rubbing out my words in the air, saying like, "You're polluting the air." So she was my first sort of censor, I guess, my first critic. But I was obsessed in a very quiet, I think healthy way with storytelling right from the get-go. But I never thought, you know, through high school, university, I never sort of envisioned it as a career. I never thought, how do I make a living at this? And that maybe in part my Canadian-ness, that we, you know, there weren't the same models of self-sufficient fiction writers who made their living based on sales alone up here, as there you know, has always been in the United States, commercial writers. And so I was, but nevertheless, still writing. Went to university, studied English. That was fun. Got a master's degree in English. That was also fun, but the fun has to come to an end. I was like, okay, look, you got to get a job. And I went to law school. I went to law school here at the University of Toronto, and recognized pretty early on that I didn't want to practice law. I was like, you know, this just doesn't feel quite right. And that's an understatement. And
I've talked to enough attorneys on the show to know that I've talked to you for all of, where's the little countdown clock, 7 minutes now, and I know you're not an attorney by trade.
It shows, doesn't it? I finished it. You know, I did that whole, you know, you never quit. My parents were always like, you know, when you start something, you never quit, which is terrible advice. But I followed it, was called to the bar, and then moved to a smaller town outside of the city and wrote a novel. And it was more of a satisfaction of a desire than it was a business plan. There was no sense that, okay, here we go, now I'm going to start, you know, writing novels for a living. It was just something I always wanted to do. And that first novel, Lost Girls, very fortunately was sold here in Canada, the United States, and the UK, and foreign rights, and there was movie rights sold. And all of a sudden, I went from being a bartender in a small town outside of Toronto to being able to do this full time. And that was 1998. And so I've been able to write fiction full time since then. That's the course of what's allowed me to do this thing that, again, I never expected to be able to do.
Which, Fest, that's why I wanted to get there first, because I think that kind of lays the groundwork for, I mean, how I normally look this up and I always lose count anyways, but you've got, I'm going to guess. Don't hate me because I'm going to guess.
Sure.
What is it, 10 books out?
Ah, bingo, you hit it.
Wow, that's normally I even count them, and the author's like, no, there's a couple more that you missed. And I'm like,
yeah, no, you got it.
I got it. So that, okay, so let's go back to those very early days. You're working full time at a bar, living in this small town. You're writing probably really late at night or really early in the afternoon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Actually writing, like pen to paper writing.
No, I think my computer was like one of those early Mac classics. You know, it was like a computer in a box, and I was then and continue to be an obsessive note taker. So I always had a notebook and pen with me, and I would take notes and observations and stuff like that. But when I was sitting down at the desk, it would have been at the computer.
Fascinates me. So were you all okay? I guess the next, I love digging into writers and their process, because I absolutely can't write, so maybe that's why. You know, there's people on the show the listeners to the show have come to learn that I can't meditate because I can't sit still long enough to do it, and I have a great affinity for writers because I can't do that either. So if it seems I'm getting full-blown nerdy on you, I just love the insights, because I think you understand it's an art and you've got to practice to get better at it. So I keep trying to learn as much as I can, because I am trying to be a better writer, and it's trying.
Mm-hmm.
Both ways you understand the English in that. Yeah. And so when you sat down to write, when you write in fiction, now see, that seems unbelievably hard to me, because I'm just trying to write, you know, technically sound stuff about the show and this, that, and the other. But you get these cast of characters. Now, how does that work for you?
Oh, it's a juggling show. I mean, it's you know, I've been, as you've correctly guessed, you know, I'm 10 novels into this career. You'd sort of think I'd learned a few things, and I guess in some respects I have, but they're not as much as you may guess or expect. You know, every book is a new puzzle, and you sort of forget overnight all the things that you presume to have learned in the previous books. And so characters, you know, you mentioned in particular, but you know, they're part of the puzzle, but it's almost like what I would boil it down to is what I've learned to be wary of is that feeling that, oh, I've got an idea for a book that comes very suddenly and it presents itself initially as this whole thing, like, you know, here's your new book, and you start into it and you realize, wait a minute, no, this is a premise maybe, but I don't really know the characters, I don't, like, what is this story really about? And then there's I've come to learn, you know, not to get too deep into this, but I now kind of think of the aboutness of a story as having two or three levels of depth to it. So there's the about of, like, here's the synopsis, here's what the story is about. Then there's a here's what the story is kind of really about, the one level below. It actually has this thematic meaning that's somewhat different and deeper than the superficial about. And then there's like another maybe one or two deeper levels of aboutness that you kind of come to understand or encounter as you're writing it. So, long way of saying, I'm a big outliner, and I do that, and I think about the story a lot before I begin, because I've run my ship aground a few times when I start too early. And it's not because it's a bad story, it's not because it's a bad idea, it's because I haven't fully kind of thought through or considered all of the aspects of the story in advance. And I think that's why a lot of amateur or people who are, you know, writing for the first time, that's why they have a tough time of it. Again, it's not because they're bad writers. It's not because their idea is poor. It's because they start too early.
So flip this the other direction for me, because I know this is, because as I'm thinking, this is probably just as true on the other side of it. Not knowing when to stop.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's especially true. So that's true on the one level of a manuscript. You know, it's like, well, I'm 180,000 words in, and I'm, you know, I think I'm now ready to start. Right? We know. You know, I think we've either read books where it felt like that, or we've heard that account from writers. But I think it's also a lot of the time it's research and preparation, that if people are writing a book about either whether it's perhaps a memoir, autobiography, or a history, or it's a fiction that's based on history, that they get so deep into the research, and it can be very fascinating and satisfying on that level alone, just learning something, and they become essentially PhDs in some corner of expertise, where they, you know what, you needed maybe 8% of that. And meanwhile, you've spent 3 years learning all of this ephemera. And there has to be I think for a fiction writer in particular, there has to be a real, real tactical question of, like, what do I need? What do I need to tell this story? Let's get in and get out. You don't have to be a bona fide expert. You don't have to, sort of be a PhD in this. You just need to know enough to tell what the story, you know, to tell the story that you have in mind, and to tell it plausibly.
So one more deep history question before we bridge forward a little bit. You've got the first book completed, and then what? Because this is obvious. You said you got it published. So how many times did you send it out, and how did that process go for a guy who's never been there and done that?
Oh, I was very... It was a very unusual and atypical scenario. So previous to the first novel, I had published a collection of short stories with a small press here in Ontario in Canada. So that was a deal, to the extent that you could call it that. that was arranged through one of the editors of a small university journal that had published a couple of my short stories, and he, unbeknownst to me, forward some of my work to an editor at a small press, and he contacted me and said, we want to publish this book. And I was delighted. The advance was enough to buy like a case of beer. And, you know, but I was as proud as could be. And when I embarked on the novel, again, I was sort of, there wasn't really a sort of a plan of publication or anything of that kind. And I had, in the meantime, though, was approached by an agent who, on the basis of the short story collection, approached me and said, I'd like to be your agent. And I told her, well, that's great, but I've got nothing for you to sell. And she said, well, no, you will. And I thought, I think she's wrong. But a couple years later, I said, well, here's this book I wrote. It's a novel. And it was even to my mind, it was like a kind of a strange hybrid of genres. It was in part a murder mystery. It was in part a ghost story. It was in part a thriller. And that actually, just as an aside, that was kind of laying out the DNA for my fiction kind of going forward. I sort of, you know, unselfconsciously specialize in books that kind of combine genres. But anyway, I gave her this book and she said, wow, you know, I love this. I don't really know how to describe it either, but let's give it a shot. And within a week, I remember on the Monday, I went around the town that I was living in at that time. I just powered through the last of my things that I had saved from my year work articling. In Ontario, you work for a year as a sort of a trainee lawyer. And so I was living on the savings from that. That was gone. So I was sending out my resume around town to be a bartender again. And on the Monday, my agent called and said, well, we sold Canadian rights. On the Tuesday, she called to say, oh, we have a 2-book offer in the States. And on Wednesday, she called to say, we have a 2-book offer in the UK. Excuse me. And then by the beginning of the next week, we had a movie option with Universal Pictures. And so, I mean, you know, that's one of those, I've never repeated quite that, you know, 7-day blowout, but that changed everything. And it, in the sense of not just sort of, oh, here's a bunch of money. You don't have to be a bartender, but it was, it showed me, oh, wait a minute. You can do this. Now, it's very hard to sustain that, but you can make a living writing fiction. And so that became the rabbit I was running after and have been running after ever since.
Yeah, well, I think you've channeled that rabbit and you've done pretty well for yourself. Okay, before we shift gears, where can people find you and find the books before we start moving into more of these different books and where we're headed today?
Oh, sure. So probably the best depot to go to would be my website, www.andrewpiper. And my last name is P-Y-P-E-R. So it's andrewpiper.com. And there you'll find information, biography, buy links and stuff like that. And I'm also fairly active and saying all sorts of nonsense on Twitter. And that's at Andrew Piper. Again, A-N-D-R-E-W. P-Y-P-E-R.
You know, I post those, like it's on my video screen, but I've never actually said that was on Twitter. I've got my name, at Mallard. Like, I just assume people know what the at sign it means on Twitter, but that's just because my bias, I'm there all the time, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I should clear that up for people who were wondering. Sorry, not sorry. So you get through that first bit of good stuff, but I'm sure you have to come back to Earth because you set a 2-book deal at one point there in that process. So now you still have to get back to work to make yourself a success at this. So was the second one harder? I mean, was it harder once you became, I don't want to say a success, but you had sold something and now had more pressure to do it, I guess is the easy way to put it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, excuse me, I didn't, at the time, I didn't perceive it as pressure, but looking back now, I don't sort of like feel pressure, you know, sort of you know, in hindsight, but I do see, oh, wait a minute, there were expectations. And I just sort of thought, oh, I'm just going to write whatever I want. And that's what I largely have pursued. But my second novel was quite different from the first. It didn't have the same kind of mystery aspect to it. It didn't share the same ground. It was quite a different book. And I think, you know, in many respects, a less likable book, or a harder book to love. And that was a lesson, and it was, you know, it was published at a high level and reasonably well reviewed, but people didn't buy it as in great as numbers and didn't like it as much. And that was a real education even if you're sort of recognized of like, okay, we recognize your talent. We like what you're able to do. Here's some money, continue to do it. That doesn't mean you get to do it at the same level of success. You know, as obvious as that ought to be, it wasn't obvious to me. And so that's not to say that I adjusted my play as I went forward. I mean, I continued to kind of follow my own inclinations, for better or for worse. I still don't have kind of a real super clear brand in the sense of I'm the werewolf guy, or I'm always spies. I'm the spy guy. There's no clear kind of brand of that sort. But to answer your question, you know, that second book was an education in, oh, you know, you can do what you want, but it doesn't mean people are going to go with you. And that invited the question, so should I think about that more? Should I think about writing to an audience? Should I define my audience and then write to them? Or no, should I just sort of, you know, just sort of insanely follow my own lead? And, you know, again, for better or for worse, I kind of went with the latter.
Yeah, I think you have to blaze your own path no matter where it goes. I guess that's part of the bias of the show that I've got going on. You just kind of follow where it goes, and some people love it and some people hate it. And I see my chatters are talking about handwriting, and I've got news for you. Mine isn't great. I mean, you said you practice a lot. Did you get good at it? I mean, I guess that's kind of subjective, right? Everything, but...
Well, I dropped out so early that evaluating myself as a lawyer is sort of like sort of, you know, trying to evaluate, you know, a 16-year-old as to, you know, you know, would he have been a great hockey player in the NHL? But I was good enough and promising enough that I got some really good job offers to join. In particular, the most tempting offer I got was to join what was at that time the most elite criminal defense firm here in Toronto. And I, you know, my roommate at that time was, I think, quite envious of me, because he really genuinely wanted to be a criminal lawyer. And he was like, oh, you don't understand. Like, I would die for that. And you got the offer? You don't even want it. And that was a real crossroads for me. There was that one moment of, whoa, this is cool. And I think I could have been, you know, I'm good at thinking on my feet. I think I'm a reasonably good speaker. I'm not easily flapped. So I thought, oh, this could be a life. And I chose, I recognized, look, this is better. This is a better opportunity for someone else. I'm not sure about this. I shouldn't take this chair. And I was right in that. But there was a moment where I was like, oh, you know, sometimes your life opens a door and you're like, if you just take one step, everything will be different. And it's hard to evaluate whether it would be better or worse, but I sort of, that door was open and I pulled it shut again. But, you know, in answer to your question, there's not enough evidence to say whether I would have been a good lawyer or not. I think I'll be pretty bad at the solicitor stuff, but probably, I guess, I would have been pretty good at the courtroom stuff.
Yeah, well, I think there's some level of being able to translate. How am I trying to say this? the ability to talk to not only people, but to a jury, like there's some element there that does, I mean, I don't want to say shredded you earlier, but I told you, you didn't sound like a lawyer to me, and that is a deep compliment. But as we talk here, I don't know if there's something there. So I do follow this, but I waffle on it. So by the end of the show, you might be a lawyer. I'm not sure if I want to say that or not, but, okay. So we're marching forward. We're getting closer to the current day, but I'm sure through that process of getting the next, you've got 10 out total. So you got the first couple under our belt. There has to be a world of tribulation in there that each one of these stories has to run and go up and down for you. And you, I don't want to say live and die with each one of these stories, but I'm sure each one of them has their own arc in your life and importance.
Oh, no, that's a very, you're absolutely right. And that's very intuitively correct. You know, that when I look back now on the books, you know, I don't reread them. Sometimes I'm asked to reread them for the purposes of adapting them to, film or TV, or overseeing someone else is adapting them for film or TV. So there's projects of that kind that are going on, but I would never voluntarily reread my earlier books, not because I think they're not good, but because it's just weird. It's sort of like going back in a time machine and kind of dating your ex-girlfriend or something. It's just something you just wouldn't choose to do. And yet, when I think about the writing, I remember the writing of the books even more profoundly than the books themselves. You know, I remember where I was, the person I was, the priorities I had going into a book. And, you know, one of the real sort of apparent ways that this can be evidenced in reading, you know, in this case, my books, is that in the early, maybe sort of three or four or five books, the stakes are attached to the protagonist, who is typically kind of a solo agent. You know, he or she is an individual who doesn't have family or has jettisoned themselves from their family. And so the stakes are, will they survive? Will they make it out? You know, the worst case scenario is, what if I die from a narrator point of view? And then, in my real life, I get married, I have children, and that shifts. And my life becomes relatively far less important and of lesser value than the lives of my children and my family and my wife. And so the stakes in the thrillers become more about someone else. It's about a protagonist who's concerned deeply about the well-being of someone else who is in danger or perhaps has been harmed or is missing. And so, you know, as obvious as that ought to have been to me, it took, you know, readers to point out to me. And the readers are always the best, because they'll point out to you, like, oh, you realize what you're doing here, right? And you're like, oh my God, no, I didn't. Thank you. But, you know, they pointed out to me, it's like, oh, you had a shift here. You became a father, and now you're writing these books about families or marriages. And they were absolutely right. And so it's one of the wonderful byproducts of being a career novelist or writing a bunch of books is that, yes, you tell stories, but in the telling of the stories, you tell a different story about yourself and your deep preoccupations. And some of the time those deep preoccupations are hidden even from yourself.
So you mentioned getting married and having children. How has that, obviously it's changed the story, right? And how you project and how you write, but has it changed how you write? Like, do you still block out periods of time during the day, or is it just as you can squeeze it in, or how's that look today?
It remains fairly uniform. You know, I work in my house. I'm now sitting in my home office on the third floor in downtown Toronto. And so my kids, their schools are within easy walking distance of here. So the mornings are very probably recognizable to many of the people listening now. You know, you get up, have the coffee, get the kids ready for school, off they go. and then you go to work. In my case, the work is, you know, straight up the stairs. I don't shower or exercise or do anything in the morning aside from making, you know, lunch and breakfast for my kids. I go straight to the office because I find that's the sort of you might not feel like it, but it's the most productive part of the day for me. I feel like I can get back into the book or the story wherever I am and get out my words. And I'm I try to be, when I'm in the middle of a project, quite strict about my word counts. And what I'll do is demand of myself, look, you need to get it, whatever the word, you know, whatever the minimum is, somewhere between 800 and 1200 words a day. And if I don't hit that count, I don't get lunch. So I have to get my 1,000 words, and if I get the 1,000 words by 11:30, okay, well, you can go downstairs and make yourself lunch. And if you don't, you're gonna, you know, you better, because you're gonna go hungry. And then in the afternoon, it's sort of like, you know, going out, groceries, those kind of regular things. So it's quite uniform and kind of work a day, punching the clock. Not necessarily by design, but I find that is for me anyway, it's the most helpful way to do it. Because if I had to wait for, you know, feeling inspired or something like that, nothing would ever get done.
I understand. That's why I do the show live, right? Because everybody else is doing podcasts in the world. But if I didn't do it 9 o'clock Eastern Tuesday nights, it may
not happen.
It may never get done again. Like,
right? No, I hear that.
May never. Like, yeah. Whatever. Okay, we'll get it. Well, yeah, we'll do this Friday. It's okay. Calm down. So let's talk about The Resident now. This is the latest one. It came out in September. So when did you finish, like, writing that? I guess we're going to start with these technical questions, and then you can sell me here pretty good. Because I think you can, I mean, the story, we've been kind of teasing it, and I wanted to save it for the end because I wanted everybody to come through this process with us to get here and then get into the story. Because I think that's where the meat of this interview we're saving it for the end. So how long ago did you actually finish it? Because I'm sure it had to go to the editor and get printed and all this other stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so, well, you know, it was in terms of a novel published by a big commercial press, it was pretty quick. And it was pretty quick because there was an interest on the publisher's side to published the book prior to the U.S. election. So going back, I probably started the book around probably, like, you know, sort of 2017. And by started, I mean, you know, sort of like, oh, wait, I kind of bumped into the origin, the real historical pieces that I became fascinated with. And then would have submitted and finalized the manuscript, you know, maybe, well, not that, you know, maybe sort of 7 or 8 months ago from where we are now. So again, in publishing terms, that's fast. That's kind of like, you know, that's electric. And the interest in, you know, because it's about, we haven't sort of, you know, said too much about this, but because it is about, the White House and about, you know, an evil entity perhaps residing in the White House, that there was a marketing interest in, oh, let's do this before November 3rd.
Yeah, and that's why you're here tonight, because I had an interest in it. But I had an interest back in September. When I first seen it, I'm like, I love it. I don't normally interview fiction authors because I find it hard for me to ask the questions I want to ask and you keep be able to sell your book.
Right.
Because I want to know how it ends, even though I kind of have an idea how yours ends, but I don't. But I kind of drill down. That's what I want to know. And for me to remain faithful to you and sell your book, that's kind of also why we started slow and kind of built up to this point. So maybe we run out of time before I have to ask you. So how does this one end? for my listeners out there, tell them about The Resonance. Give them the full, whatever it is. I don't want to say soundbite because that's not true. You probably can do a much better job of selling it than I can.
Oh, sure. So, The Residence is a ghost story set in the White House, and it is one that's based on real, true historical events, specifically those relating to the Franklin Pierce administration of 1853 to 1857. Franklin Pierce is, or was, among I'm going to be generous to him here, among the least well-regarded American presidents, and certainly among the most overlooked. You know, I had never, for example, heard of Franklin Pierce before I bumped into him in my research into haunted houses. But The Residence is about Franklin Pierce, his one-term administration, and his relationship with his first lady and wife, Jane Pierce, both of whom suffered an unimaginable series of losses before their moving into the White House, specifically the loss of all three of their children. The last of whom, Benny, was 12 years old, and he died and was the sole fatality in a bizarre train derailment that occurred just weeks before the Pierce inauguration. And it was on that train, Pierce and Jane were on the train with Benny, and they lost their last living child. So they both moved into the White House suffering unimaginable grief. And Jane moved into the second floor residence, which was, you know, at that time the White House was only two floors high, but it was on the second floor that the first family would have resided. She moved into her rooms and refused to come out. She did not do any of the normal social, you know, the teas, the meetings, the dinners that would normally have been served by first ladies. Instead, she spent her time writing letters to her dead son, Benny, in which she pleaded with him to return to her. And according to her letters, he did, not in a ephemeral, phantasmical form, but according to her letters, in material form, he came to her in her room in the White House, appeared, moved out of the corner of the room, came to her at the side of the bed, stroked her, comforted her. And that is, along with a few other facts, but that primary correspondence that is known to history and verifiably so, is the way into what I write as, launching from those facts, a ghost story / horror novel about the Pierce administration, what the Pierces endured in the White House, and what they brought to the White House in a supernatural sense that may be with us today.
You know, I was just thinking this, and one of my chatters popped it up there. It sounds like Mary Lincoln, and I'm sitting here thinking, Pierce took office in 1852? I think I've seen that, 53 somewhere. I mean,
yeah, 53, yep.
Okay, close enough. Not bad for not writing it down, recalling from earlier today. So from 52 to 65, when Lincoln was assassinated, that's a 13-year period. I know the Lincolns lost one or two children while they were there, and then we have this one who was on the way there, and it just, I mean, that energy, being the paranormal guru guy that I am here at this point, that sorrow, that deep loss has to leave a horrible, I mean, I just can't imagine losing a child, I guess is the clean way to put that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be the, not be a, but be the public figure at that point, or, you know.
Absolutely. No, it is, it's almost unimaginable to, and then imagine then on top of that, the impact that would have on, a marriage, and a marriage that is expected to be very public, when one of the members of it, Jane, with very good reason, refused to play the public game. So Franklin was very alone, and that was why, and this is one of the really fascinating aspects of the novel in my research that I was surprised by. It was at that time fairly regular practice for presidents, senators, congressmen who had wives that were ill or otherwise indisposed, or for bachelors who didn't have wives, to hire the services of a substitute. And so a substitute would have been a woman who would perform the role of a public wife, but who was not that man's wife. And Franklin Pierce had a substitute. Jane chose her herself. It was Abby, her cousin, and longtime child, since they're friends since childhood. And they were known to be very similar women, very similar in their appearance. Abby a little bit more lively. Jane was always ill and sickly and depressed. So Abby was almost a kind of a perkier, livelier, more appealing version of his own wife. And she resided, didn't reside in the White House, but resided nearby and would attend events with Franklin. So that would, from a psychological point of view, that would be a further complication. Here's a man who's lost his child, all of his children. His wife is not available to him in any emotional sense. And yet here's this woman who is sort of a doppelganger for his wife, who is attending fun, candlelit social functions with him. Just a bizarre, it's almost a sort of a surreal dream. But that was all sort of, this is again all part of the historical record. And Jim, just as an aside, just because I don't want to, you mentioned earlier about Mary Lincoln. And I think it's one of the other things, and this gets me quite excited, nerdily, in my research, is that so Benny Pierce, 12 years old, dies in the train accident I've mentioned, and he is, according to Jane, brought back from the dead. You have, with the Lincolns, only two administrations later, you have Willie Lincoln, the exact same age as Benny, 12 years old, dies in the White House. Mary Lincoln is known on the historical record to have conducted more than one seance attempting to make contact with Willie. And there's prevalent historical supposition that Lincoln himself was present at least some of those seances. You have a few administrations later, during the Taft administration, 1909-1913, multiple accounts of people who lived and worked at the White House at that time seeing and encountering terrifying encounters with a young adolescent boy, roughly 12 years old, who they called the Thing. And Taft was so troubled by this and so distracted that he issued a memo saying, no one can talk about the Thing anymore. We agree, we will not talk about it anymore. It's almost like he, perhaps himself, encountered the Thing. This recurring supernatural appearance of, in this case, a 12-year-old boy, but there are other figures within White House lore that repeats itself, was completely surprising to me and fascinating.
You know, it makes me think of a story that I was told here on the show. I was told here on the show, I was going to tell you how long ago it was, but it's been a couple of years. I had former Secret Service agent John Carman on, who was telling me about a Secret Service agent in the basement of the White House who pulled down and shot at something that wasn't there.
Whoa, I have not heard that. That's amazing.
I'll have to dig that up and send it over to you. If I don't, remind me, because I forget these things. I say a lot of things I'm going to do, but because he casually dropped it right before the show. Hey, I've got the best ghost story you've ever heard. Now, I'm in the paranormal, and we're into the paranormal stuff, and people tell me that a lot. And then he proceeded to tell me that story. I mean, that's the punchline of the story. I mean, he went into better detail than that, but yeah, that is probably the greatest ghost story I've ever been told. And as we bridge the gap from that was like in 1980-ish, somewhere in there, to back to the day, but as we're sitting here, makes me really, I wish I could get, full access, but of course I know that's never going to happen, but just be fun.
Yeah, I'll hound you for that, because that's an amazing aspect. It's not, you know, sort of the deeper you dig into, but you know, you get beyond the sort of the touristy brochure lore of the White House ghost. You know, here's, you know, Lincoln's ghost and stuff. You do uncover a very rich and I think very real history of genuine people encountering just very strange stuff in that building.
So let's rewind the tape, because before we got way too heavy, which is fine, but it really did. You said you're looking at ghost stories. So were you out looking for a ghost story to write about, or were you just generally fascinated by ghost stories, especially since it's that time of year where we can talk about these things?
Well, you know, a couple years ago when I stumbled on it, no, it was just recreational rabbit holing on the internet. You know, I'm perhaps like a lot of people, you know, listening now, you know, you spend time online following your sort of minor obsessions. And for me, you know, I might start off like checking tomorrow's weather, and I end up invariably looking at, you know, recent Sasquatch videos or, you know, UFO abduction accounts or haunted houses. You know, that's where I kind of, my interests lead. And it was during one of those time-wasting evenings that I, you know, sort of was digging a little bit deeper into American haunted houses. I was sort of like, what's the most haunted house in America? And yes, there's this place, that place. And one of my searches led me to the White House. I was like, yeah, I've heard it all before. And that's when I discovered the Pierces and Jane Pierce's letters in particular. And that was when I knew, oh, okay, hold on. I've never heard of this before. And what an interesting, the characters of the Pierces, these people who'd lost everything, and then more or less were immediately vaulted into this position of great responsibility and power, just when the country was, you know, being tugged and torn over the, you know, the question of slavery and how to resolve it or not, was just sort of was so dramatic and interesting to me that I thought, oh, I went immediately from, oh, I'm just wasting time, to I think this is a novel.
It is. I mean, obviously it is. And obviously played out in your head. I'm still, there's so many things whistling through my head at this point, it makes it hard to think and have this conversation. Probably another reason I wanted to wait and get into this a little bit more. But, of course, as you develop this, you've obviously started with a based on true story. I mean, obviously these events happened. How hard did it become to then, I don't want to say ramp it up, but that's the only phrase that comes to mind, and turn it into a work of fiction with some truth in it. How hard is that for you to walk that line until you don't walk that line anymore?
Well, one of the benefits of dealing with the Pierces, yes, they were, you know, Pierce was an American president. So on that level, you know, that's pretty rich history. It's well documented. There's fame and recognition involved in that. But I had the benefit of him being probably the least known American president. And so there was a space. There were spaces there for me to enter into the account, fictionalize, and in, you know, the novel, The Residence is quite, you know, it's quite clearly fictional. I mean, the things that I have happened, many of the things that have happened are clearly fantastical. But I wanted it to be, you know, to not divorce itself too much from the historical record and from just plausible reality. And so that was the balance, was, yes, respecting the historical record. Yes, being true to who these characters were, or how they were appreciated, or what we can know about them now. And at the same time, telling a gripping, scary ghost story and a horror story and a thriller that doesn't divorce too much from what is known, and being respectful, not in the sense of laying flowers at the grave of the Pierces, but being respectful in the sense of their characters. And seeing how those characters would have played out in a situation that would have been, again, very very dark and very difficult for them to have endured. And so it was, you know, I would, my advice to other, you know, writers who might be out there who are like, oh yeah, I want to write a historical fiction novel, is, you know, my advice would be choose someone who's famous but not that famous, because it's into those spaces that you can, you know, create your own story.
Yeah, I was sitting here thinking about my friend of the show, Bill O'Brice Jr., who played in the Lincoln versus Zombies movie. The spoof of the other one, the Zombie Hunter one.
Yeah.
And good friend of the show. I mean, loves the show. He'll probably be listening to this one whenever he... especially since they're not doing much. I think he told me they were starting to pick back up. But anyways, not to get off into that side tangent about him, but... I know when I first watched that, I mean, as much as you try to quote-unquote relax and enjoy the show, you know too much history, and it becomes such a argument with yourself. Like, that's just not right, let alone the fact that he's chasing zombies around, right? Like,
you're right.
Like, there's that part of people that just can't let that go. I mean, the rest of the story's fine, but you just need it, you know, like, just need to be a little more historically accurate while chasing those zombies, which don't right. have any place in it. Which, it's got to be... I mean, that's where the fine line comes that I'm interested in trying to flesh out and figure out, because... But, I mean, like I said, I did enjoy the movie, and I do enjoy Bill, but there's those moments it's like, that isn't right.
No. Yeah. But I think, you know, it's interesting. I think you get... It's odd, because you get that breadth, or that opportunity to have Lincoln, you know, beheading vampires, because Lincoln is so much more iconic than, say, Franklin Pierce. You know, he's so much more well-known. He's so much more important. He's so much more mythical in the American understanding, as well as the American imagination, that you can conceivably have him be a vampire hunter. Whereas if I were to write Franklin Pierce Vampire Hunter, it'd be like, first of all, who's Franklin Pierce? I mean, it wouldn't work. So it's almost like you have to calibrate lesser-known people. Lesser-known people you can tell more personal, private stories about, because we don't know their private life. Whereas bigger figures like Lincoln, if you're going to tell a truly fictional story about Lincoln, I think you might as well bring in zombies and vampires, because they are so well-known.
Yeah. Such a fine line. Okay, so that's The Resonant. It's out, available via your website, I'm assuming everywhere else, right? Amazon, all
sure.
Fun places.
Yep, all those places.
Also, I think I see that was available on Audible, which might be a way to go for some people. I know that, especially since I'm doing an audio-based show, that might be something you might want to check out. And no, I don't have the shameless Audible plug at this point. Just go listen to another. I mean, they're out there. Go find it for free. I'm sure people have it.
Yeah,
the Audible download a free book deal, not just skimming the backside of the internet for his book. Not saying
no.
That.
No.
No. That wasn't what I said. So calm down, everybody. Especially you. No. So we talked about all this writing stuff, and up in my chat room it popped up, well, you didn't ask him about writer's block. What do you do? Because, I mean, obviously you're saying you're trying to get 8 to 1,000 words before lunch. And what if it just doesn't come, and how do you get out of that and break that cycle?
Well, you know, this might be, it sounds easy, but so this might be unhelpful advice, but excuse me, I find on the occasions where I'm having a tough time with it, I find it helpful to remind myself that there is no such thing as writer's block. You know, that is, if you were like suffering writer's block and you went to your doctor and you had a doctor and said, oh my God, this seems like a very serious case, let's get an MRI done, and you had a full body MRI, you know, writer's block would not show up, right? It's not like, oh, there it is, I see it. It's there, right, you know, hiding behind your spleen. There's your writer's block. It is something we tell ourselves to explain perhaps something else. And so for me, some of the helpful, you know, workarounds or ways to kind of diminish the oppressive weight of what we might assign the name writer's block is to not be where we are when we're suffering it. So if you're like, okay, here I'm at the writer's table, you know, the kids are asleep or whatever, husband's at work, and I'm going to do this thing now, and it's not working. Don't sit there and kind of wait for magic to strike. You know, get up, bring your notebook and a pen and go for a walk. Go for a walk around the block. Or go to your bookshelf and pull off randomly, more or less, a book that you have already read and that you know that you like, and open it up at a random midpoint, mid-page, and read a paragraph. Something that's sort of like, it disrupts the brain from thinking, I can't do this, I'm blocked. And it kind of, instead of trying to solve that or cure it, you say, okay, fine, you can think that, I'm going to go for a walk. Okay, you can think that, I'm just going to read a page of this book from a writer that I love. And the brain gets distracted too and stops complaining, and you have your own thoughts. And so that would be my kind of therapist's advice for writer's block. A, remind yourself this isn't real. B, do something else. And C, your brain wants to tell the story. If you're setting out to write a book, you know that this is something you want to do. You know that you have an interest in this. So when you feel those impediments, it's not about like, oh, I can't do this, or I have a block. It's about your brain is just kind of messing with you. So you just have to relax, do something else, and then it'll get back. It'll sort of find the rails again.
So as I look at the clock, we've got just about 4 minutes left, and I've got to tell you, fun little story. I don't know where this is going, but, you know, it seems appropriate at this point as we're talking about historical works of fiction that weave history and stuff together. Obviously, one of my favorite movies of all time is National Treasure with Nicolas Cage. And I still swear every time I bring this up, that's just a documentary of his life. There's nothing fictional about this. It's just how that guy lives. Yeah. People are like, no, that's okay. I'm like, no. I'm pretty sure if we actually followed him around, that's how that guy lives. And, the family is in Philadelphia, and so I pushed the kids up together to get their picture taken with the Liberty Bell, and then I decide I want one with the Liberty Bell as well. Yeah, I get a selfie. And I look over and say, I'm going to slide under the bottom there and take a picture. Which the, where the large security guard, you know, because, you know, they got this thing roped off, you can't get within 5 feet of it on any side, said, don't even think about it. And I said, I'm not going to touch it. I'm just going to take a picture up under. And he looks at me and says, don't even think about it. And at that point, I felt the need to leave the building. Because...
Do you think if you had sort of scuttled under there, do you think he would have grabbed you by the ankles and pulled you out?
Yeah, without question. Yeah. I wouldn't even probably got that far before...
Right.
I probably wouldn't even hit the floor before I was hitting the floor. I get the feeling like just based on that tone, he's probably tired of everybody's joke. I'm sure everybody has a joke like that. I'm sure, but I think you could have smiled, because obviously it is probably high enough that I could have fit under it, but I'm not exactly sure that I could have.
And
I'm not going to be the guy that has this national relic land on me because I was trying to be cute.
You don't want to be that guy. No.
Yeah. I guess maybe it would have crushed me and maybe it'd be okay. Like, I wouldn't have to deal with it. Like, you know, I'm sure that thing weighs a few pounds. So, Andrew, hey, I appreciate you and I appreciate the story. I'm glad that you found it and brought it back so we could all kind of talk about it again.
Oh, well, my pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate this.
And that's Andrew, Pryor.com. Piper.
Yep.
I'm sorry.
Yep. That's okay.
Such a complex website and such a hard name to pronounce, I still butchered it. That's good. Well, are you working on another book?
I've started into a new book, and then there's a couple of, as I mentioned, sort of TV and film projects that are percolating based on some previous books. So, yeah, jumping around between projects. So, it's busy, you know, that's one of the benefits of being a writer in a pandemic is that, you know, you get to do the work.
So I see the question in my chat room. I look at the clock. See, we've got like 50 seconds. Have you seen a ghost yourself?
Never. But I give a lot of, historically at least, I used to give a lot of readings, and a lot of people would come to them and would tell me ghost stories. And people have told me so many ghost stories, I'm a believer for sure.
Good. Hey, whenever you get one of these things finished up and you want to come talk about it, you know where to find me, right?
Thanks so much, Jim. I will, yeah.
All right, have a good evening.
You too.
And there we go. Another good one in the books there. Bad pun, good one in the books. Yeah, there you go. I'm looking forward to next week with live predictions next week. The following week, we're going to get into nuts and bolts marketing. I think that's the following week. I shouldn't really talk about these things that I don't have my book in front of me. I'll talk.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, cut.
Oh, come on. It wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on CannedAirPodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.